Hi, my name's Jenna. I'm calling from Somerville, New Jersey.
My name is Rachel. I live in Eugene, Oregon.
Not having enough money is stressful in every aspect of your life.
We're always struggling for money. As soon as we get anything in savings, it goes right back out the door on tires or car maintenance or shoes for the kids.
You think about things that you need to buy, like supplies for the house, toilet paper and things like that, and hope they go on sale soon.
Well, we try really hard not to make it our son's problem while still giving him the language that everything in this world costs money.
Minor car problems turn into major things, and you can't afford to take care of yourself like you want to eat healthy, or in my case, even go to the dentist, and you feel it as a constant throbbing ache in your jaw and in your life.
All week, we've been looking at wealth in America. Who's got it, who doesn't, and why it's so hard to attain. Many of you know what that feels like. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, the stress of being poor. Studies show that your wealth is directly connected to your health. And though the United States is the wealthiest country in the world, as we've been hearing this week, where that wealth falls is getting increasingly uneven. Take Strawberry Mansion, a low-income neighborhood in North Philadelphia. Richard Wright Elementary School is a school in Strawberry Mansion with about 360 students from pre-K to the fifth grade. The poverty rate in the school's zip code, 19132, is 40%, and the median household income is $23,000. That's less than half of the national average. And that poverty could have a psychological impact that can trickle down to kids. Janine Payne is the principal of Richard Wright Elementary School.
There is a student that comes directly to my mind, a young girl at our school, and she has been in outpatient therapy since before kindergarten age, so we'll say about four or five, ongoing. She has been removed from her mother. Her mother has signed away parental rights, so she's been in foster care. She was with one family that was pre-adoptive, but then due to circumstances that we could not find out, she was removed from that house while they went into counseling. And during that time, she was placed in, I lost count at about seven different foster family homes that she was with. It was so high that they actually had to change agencies for her because they ran out of families in the one agency that she was with. During that time, her behavior spiked and they considered putting her on medication. Meanwhile, nobody is thinking that perhaps the instability of home and her not even knowing who was going to pick her up on certain afternoons from school was affecting her ability to, you know, maintain her behavior. And I recently found out that she also has twin brother sister siblings that she hasn't seen in over a year.
So tell me about what that does to her and students like her who are going through this in terms of learning, in terms of the day-to-day impact on their education.
First of all, she's a model of resilience because she still manages to be very academically functional. Do I believe she's actually doing as well as she can? Of course not. There is no way that we can look at her and say that she is using the full capacity of what she's able to do to engage in reading and math if, again, she's worried about what adult is going to take me from school today and where am I going to end up tonight. It's really sad, amazing that she still manages to come to school each day, which again is not her home, and trust us to take care of her and engage with us with our task, which is to educate her, until she goes back into this cycle at the end of the day.
Do you think we're aware? I think often when we being, you know, adults in this country think about stress, we think about our own stress, right? How our commutes and paying the mortgage and things like that. Do you think there's enough awareness about basically what we're talking about, which is childhood stress as a result of these external factors, poverty, et cetera, and the impact that they have on children's ability to learn?
Not only do I think we're really not aware, but then you can extend that a little bit to say there's just a lack of sensitivity. And I would extend that. So we talked about an extreme case just then, but let's go to a less extreme common case of your basic kindergartner. And I'm talking about a regular kindergartner that may come from a stable household, whatever the family unit is, was fed in the morning, has all of their clothes. This child exists at knee level, walking into a building for the first day on the first day of school on a schedule totally different from anything that they've had before with people that they've never really seen before. And we put them in lines and lead them around buildings and open doors that are much bigger than them, tell them they can't go to the bathroom when they feel like it. I couldn't imagine what kind of stress in a child's mind that is. And that's normal. That's an expectation that we give to children just for the first day of school. Now you add all of those basic housing security, food security, social emotional stability. When you pile that on to a child, it's really a huge endeavor.
And just briefly, can you tell us what some of the longer term consequences of this type of stress, food insecurity, poverty, et cetera, will have on children?
We can start with just the research around the adverse childhood experiences. I would refer anyone and everyone to the TED Talks that was led by Dr. Nadine Birx-Harris, where she talks about, we're talking about taking years off of children, people's lives. The number of adverse childhood experiences in a full inventory can determine what the likelihood of you, of the your life expectancy is. So once you get beyond that, which is just how long will you live, then what you do while you're alive, what you're able to persist through and do, what you're able to carve the area of your brain and your focus and your psyche to be able to dedicate to absorbing, comprehending, and processing academia. You know, if you're trying to budget for groceries, it's kind of hard for me to take your focus away for trigonometry. If you're trying to figure out how to heat your home, you know, the physics of a moving car, and you may never own one, is not that important. So you're really asking people to step outside of what their regular daily existence and possible survival needs are to absorb this information that we tell people, children, is important. And I just don't think we have enough appreciation for the magnitude of that task.
Janine Payne, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Janine Payne is the principal of Richard Wright Elementary in North Philadelphia.
Poverty is one of the biggest killers in the United States.
Beth Truesdale is a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, and we reached out to her for more context on the link between wealth and mental health.
Growing up poor has a very, very long arm. People who grow up poor tend to have higher rates of stress, of poor mental health, of anxiety, of depression, of diabetes, of heart disease, and they die younger.
Truesdale says that these conditions can take root when you're young. About 20% of children in the United States are living in situations where their families may not have enough food to make it to the end of the month.
Certainly a lot of research now is attending to this link between parents' well-being and children's well-being. And they're really understanding that you can't help children without also helping the parents. People call it a two-generation strategy. We know that kids who grow up in very deprived circumstances experience what some researchers call toxic stress. Toxic stress is the kind of thing that we have some good evidence that it actually affects the way that children's brains develop, especially in the first few years of their lives, in ways that can have very serious long-run consequences for their physical and mental health.
But adults, of course, experience it too. Living paycheck to paycheck, as many Americans do, without wealth, even changes how you think.
There's also a thing that happens inside people's minds when they're confronted with less than they need. And one answer is that they're experiencing something that researchers call scarcity. If you've ever been up against a time crunch, you know how scarcity works. When you're up against a deadline, you become really good at doing whatever you have to do in order to meet the deadline. But there's a price to pay for this extra focus. Psychologists call it tunneling. Anything that falls outside your narrow mental tunnel of focus gets ignored, it gets put off to a later date. So you don't exercise because you're busy. And people who live in situations of chronic poverty where they're having difficulty paying debt, they're likely to be taxed like this, cognitively taxed.
And just like with wealth gaps, health gaps tell an important story. The rich are getting healthier and the poor are not.
On most measures, we continue to see average health of the U.S. population improving. But what those improving averages do is they hide really big gaps. And we've seen that mortality rates, the life expectancy for people with a college degree, people who are at the top of the income distribution, that's gotten better and better and better. But for people who are farther down the income distribution, we see a flattening off, and in some groups of the population, even a decline in people's health and well-being and in the age at which they die.
Hi, my name is Rosie, and I'm a mom of four, and I work really hard at two jobs, and I think it is way more impossible to create wealth and save money than many, many people may understand. And my kids are young. I'm looking at college ahead. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I think people would be, people who don't experience trying to live on a budget, trying to save money, people who are making minimum wage, I really, truly believe don't get it necessarily. And I wish they did.
Hi, my name is Stephanie. I'm from Minneapolis. My single mom struggled a lot with money, and she never let us know. In fact, when I was little, she told us about how little Debbie treats were really exciting. And so she hid all of her money problems from us. And because of that, my brother and I had an extremely happy childhood. We never knew. The downside is that since I've become an adult, I don't know how to manage my money. And I've struggled severely with credit card debt in my most recent days. It's become a serious issue in my marriage, and it's actually putting a delay on our having children.
You can always call 877-8-MY-TAKE to respond to the conversation you just heard. And our big thanks to WHYY and their Broke in Philly series for their reporting on trauma-directed programs in Philly schools. When we come back, we're talking about the Me Too movement and the Juno Diaz saga. It's a big, important conversation that you really don't want to skip. And by the way, you need to do us a solid here. If you like this podcast, we need you to rate us, review us, and tell all of your news-loving friends about us. Share it on Facebook, Twitter, or anywhere you share smart things. And we love you for it. Thanks so much.
I don't know about you, but I find this news cycle exhausting. One night you go to sleep, and when you wake up, there is a different Secretary of State. Robert Mueller has indicted someone new, and the president is friends with Kanye West? In times like these, we rely on your guidance more than ever. We need you to do your part by connecting with us online. If you like what you hear, tweet at The Takeaway, or post a comment on our Facebook page, or you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
When the Me Too movement exposed the ugly reality of sexual misconduct and abuse in the United States last fall, the allegations brought down dozens of men. There was Harvey Weinstein to start, and then the actors like Kevin Spacey and comedians like Louis C.K., lawmakers like Blake Farenthold and Al Franken, and journalists like Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose. We also faced a reckoning on this show before I got here. Women and men around the world celebrated what looked like the end of unchecked abuse. But men like Terry Gilliam, Liam Neeson, and Alec Baldwin have questioned Me Too, as have some women. In January, French actress Catherine Deneuve denounced the movement, and writer Caitlin Flanagan argued in defense of Aziz Ansari. And in April, dozens of women signed a letter in defense of Tom Brokaw. So was it the beginning of a backlash? Well, whatever you want to call it, the fact is these stories and our responses to them are inherently complicated, and race makes them even more so. Take the case of acclaimed writer Juno Diaz. Complaints of sexual misconduct and of verbally abusive behavior that many saw as misogynistic or machista surfaced not long after the author shared his own history of abuse as a child. And some have accused Diaz of being part of the same machismo culture he writes so much about. Then this week, a group of prominent Latina scholars co-signed an open letter that attempted to offer a defense of Diaz against what they saw as unfair treatment by the media. I sat down with two women on different sides of this issue. Marianela Belliard had a negative encounter with Diaz when she was in grad school, and she was disappointed and hurt by the letter. Linda Martin Alcoff is a professor of philosophy at CUNY's Hunter College, and she was one of the signatories.
I think the purpose of the letter is not to defend or convict Juno Diaz, but to take the opportunity that this case affords to address some issues that, you know, people in Me Too, and I think we're speaking from within the Me Too movement, really feel like need to be addressed more, like racism and sexism in the same sentence. And I think when you have a man of color who is accused, there's always sort of a concern about the way in which these very ready narratives about men of color as sort of unredeemable predators can be hyped up in the mainstream media world to make people feel like they have a definitive understanding of the situation when, you know, maybe there's more complexity. So what that does is it shuts down the complexity of some cases. I mean, some cases are not complex at all. They are completely unambiguous. This case, I think, is an opportunity for us to explore the complexities because it involves racism, sexism, victimization, and possible abusive behavior at the same time.
Marianela, I want to bring you into the conversation. You've written about your own disappointment with Juno Diaz and that he was somebody whose work was elevated in the Dominican culture, in literature, in the greater American popular culture. I mean, I remember seeing copies of This Is How You Lose Her and so many other of his books being read all over the country. What did his success mean to you? And why was the truth about how he was conducting his personal and professional life so devastating?
Before I answer that, I totally agree, Linda, that, and I thought that the intention of the letter was going around those lines. However, I think we have to be careful because we do need to discuss the media stereotypes of Latino men, and especially in the context of the anti-immigrant and toxic environment. I mean, we have a president who launched a campaign labeling Mexican men as rapists. Right. When we all knew that Mexican was a euphemism for my brother, for your cousin, for every Latino man. Mm-hmm. However, we have to continue hearing the accounts and the voices that are expressing their disappointment. And now I can get into your question, Tanzina, how, for example, it affected me. See, the disappointment came from very diverse angles, as a woman, as a Dominican woman, as somebody who shared a very similar background with Juno. And so I was in grad school. I was the scholar in residence at Wellesley College. I found out he was going to give a talk, and he was going to read at Brandeis University, which is not that far from Wellesley. So I made it to the talk. We started talking, and at the end of the dinner, he said, "Can you drive me back?" And I said, "Sure." And he made some sexual advances, and then I said, hey, slow down." And he kissed me. He was getting a little bit too frisky, and I pushed him a little bit, and I said, "You know, no, come on, Juno." He put his hand on my head, and he touched my hair, and said, "Wow, pelito bueno, you know, good hair." And I said, "What?" And so he said, "But is it real?" And I said, no, come on. So he started, he held my head and he wanted to push my bangs back to see if it was real, if it was truly good hair. I said, "Oh no, come on." And then I said, you know, now he's getting really stupid. And then he said, you know, "I'm a little tired." And I said, "No, so am I. And I have to drive back to Wellesley. So, you know, it was nice meeting you. And it was a great talk." And that was it. And so we said goodbye and I left. But on the way back, it was when it really hit me. And as I was driving, and then I started to cry. And then I said, "But wait a minute, why am I crying? Am I being stupid?" And then I said, no, it was very disappointing because he went into the racial stereotypes of Dominican culture of pelo bueno, pelo malo, you know, good hair, bad hair. And I couldn't understand why he was doing that.
Professor Alcoff, I want to turn to you. I'm wondering if you can share with us some examples of where specifically Juno Diaz was maligned as a Latino versus somebody who was inappropriate with women.
Well, I think there's a number of examples that, you know, might be that sort of thing. But I think the real question is, how do we address that without silencing the stories and cases of women? I mean, I'm a survivor of childhood sexual assault around the same age as Juno, so I'm very much identified with his story. I'm also the victim as a professor in the academy of, you know, there's all kinds of shenanigans that people play who are professors or who have power against students and more vulnerable people, and I've experienced that as well. And I think, you know, one of the things we need to do to avoid silencing women is to stop thinking that if we have personal experiences, that that's invalidating of our voices. And that's what has silenced us for so long. And I think what's different about this moment is in the past, because of the vilification of men of color, which has been a long story, because of that, some men of color have used the demand for racial solidarity as a way to silence women of color, to silence them from making charges of sometimes pretty serious cases of abuse. And I think that's what we're seeing changing in this moment, and that's really important.
And aren't we capable of saying, on the one hand, you know what, there are issues of machismo, which is masculine, the version of sexism in Latino cultures, and that's real, right? And at the same time, we can make these distinctions in terms of when, you know, that's these are men behaving badly, et cetera, et cetera. I feel like we're able to make those distinctions. What's interesting to me is that this isn't the first time we've seen a group of women come out and speak against, you know, speak out essentially sort of defending, if you will, in some ways, or clarifying some behavior. So we saw this with Catherine Deneuve in France, and a group of women there wrote a letter. We saw this with Tom Brokaw in New York. A group of journalists got together and you know, wrote a letter in support of Tom Brokaw. Is it a woman's responsibility, or collectively women's responsibility, to stand up for this type of behavior, to make these clarifications?
I think the fact of the matter is, as we hear more voices, there's going to be disagreement, right? There's going to be differences. And we have to be able to hear that. So that's part of the unsilencing. But some of the junior women who signed the letter are now getting some pretty serious pressure from their institutions to resign. So, you know, it's difficult to speak out on every side of this issue. There are stakes and costs.
And Marianela, I'm curious, how much do you think race or ethnicity or Latinidad in this case is getting in the way of the bigger issue that is, you know, allegedly Junot Diaz's difficult encounters, if you will, with women?
Wow. Yes, it does get in the way, because it is an undeniable fact. We're talking about a Latino author. And I think to try to dismiss that is also a disservice to the movement and to the moment. I think we have to speak and take it into account, because this is a perfect moment to expand the conversation to people of color in general in the academy, who are often expected to be brilliant, unique, and in the context of tokenism, also representatives of an entire race or ethnicity.
Well, and let's talk about that tokenism, because I feel like that's a big problem, right? Marianela, I mean, would you, and Professor Alcoff is also nodding her head here, the issue of tokenism with Junot specifically.
Well, a lot of the people in the Latino community for a long time have been really concerned. You know, many even said that Junot Diaz was sucking up the air. They were leaving very little space for other writers. But I think this is where Linda's point should be taken into account, because this was the system. You know, I don't necessarily say that this was Junot Diaz's responsibility either. But there was this kind of minstrelsy and misogyny inherent in Diaz's work, as well as the way it was being read. And some people have raised some very important questions. How do we continue reading Diaz? Well, the question is, how have you been reading Diaz? And in what context? And how do you discuss his writing, you know? And to me, this is, I think, a very important moment for a larger discussion within the academy. Because oftentimes minority professors, especially if they're young, they're expected to be a star and always be performing, if you will, you know, performing their identity.
Professor Alkoff, I wonder if you might sort of help us understand this, because when is it appropriate then for people of color, in this case women of color, in this case Latinas, when can we criticize our idols or our heroes, essentially, right? Because I think that's a tension that exists for lots of communities of color, underrepresented, marginalized communities, right? If we collectively do not support each other in solidarity, then we know the stakes are high. We know that there's a lot to lose, right? If one of us, if you will, screws up, you know, then it affects all of us, right, ultimately. And that's an unfortunate part of tokenism. It's an unfortunate part of the way that our society works. But there's another unfortunate part of this, which is abuse.
Part of what we often do is we don't air our dirty laundry because we are minorities, because we are under the gun, because there are all these ready narratives to read us in one way or another. I think the difficulty in this new moment is how to think about the complications. You know, there's the question of individual responsibility versus structural responsibility. And some people who talk about structural responsibility are accused of giving people a pass on individual responsibility, changing the conversation. And I think we have to push back against that idea that it's an either or. In my view, every adult individual has to take responsibility for everything that they do, no matter what traumatic things have happened to them. But we also have to talk about and think about the structural conditions that provides opportunities for abusers, provides excuses for their behavior, and sometimes provides even training in the ways of domination. And actually, Diaz is writing, you know, is the Oscar Wilde book in particular, as well as Drown, I think, thematizes these issues in a way that many people have found productive when they're teaching his work. So it's not a question of the individual responsibility goes down if we focus on the systemic and the structural. We have to keep all of these on the same page.
Marianela, any closing thoughts?
I'm happy that we're having this conversation. I think it's a very important conversation to be had, and it's been long overdue. It's unfortunate that we've reached this moment at the same time that a very dear and appreciated writer, as Junot Diaz has been for the community, is also losing his steam, you know, in his status, in his in what he has achieved. And that is the sad part. That is the conflictive part that, it, at least, and I'm speaking for myself, was so difficult to reconcile and was so difficult for me to even put into words. And as I said, as someone who shares so much with Junot Diaz, and as far as the background and the experiences and the working mother, I felt that it was also my responsibility to speak up and to make sure that the voices would not be drowned, and that this was not an issue of Dominicanidad or Latinidad, that this was really an issue of power, abuse of power, and patriarchal practices.
Professor Alkoff, final thoughts?
The further question that we really wanted to, you know, think about is the future. What is the future articulation of, you know, what we want in the Me Too movement? And does that include sexists who have expressed repentance, right? Can repentant sexists be part of the coalition? Can we imagine people changing? And some argue that Diaz has changed a lot in the last few years, at least. Can we imagine such persons as playing a role? People who have been abusive might be great educators. So I think the question of the future directed goals, as well as past directed redressing and airing of harms, needs to be put on the table, and that's what we were hoping to move toward.
Linda Martin-Alkoff is a professor of philosophy at the City University of New York Hunter College and author of Rape and Resistance. She is also one of the co-signers of the open letter about Junot Diaz. And Marianela Belliard is a writer and PhD in comparative literature, and she's the author of the essay Junot Diaz's Masks, This is How He Lost It in Latino Rebels. Thank you both for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Hey people, Jay Cowett, director of The Takeaway here with our question of the day. And here it is. Have you ever considered running for public office? President, governor, dog catcher, anything. Have you ever considered running? What was your motivation? Did your wealth or finances make a difference in your choice? We want to know. Give us a call here at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a voice memo at our website, thetakeaway.org/mytake. We'll be playing some of your responses on the show tomorrow. See you then.
I've come here today voluntarily as a witness and as a whistleblower. Cambridge Analytica sought to identify mental vulnerabilities in voters and worked to exploit them by targeting information designed to activate some of the worst characteristics in people, such as neuroticism, paranoia, and racial biases. When I was at Cambridge Analytica, I was also made aware of the firm's black ops capacity. I have seen documents relating to instances where the firm sought to procure hacked material. Some of the targets of these special intelligence services are currently heads of state in various countries.
That's Christopher Wiley, former director of research at Cambridge Analytica and its London affiliate SCL Group. And today, he's known as the whistleblower. Wiley testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday amid reports that both the FBI and the Justice Department are investigating the now-defunct company accused of harvesting private data from 50 million Americans and potentially violating election laws. Tony Rahm is technology reporter for The Washington Post, and he was following Wednesday's hearing. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. So tell us what was new in terms of what Christopher Wiley revealed in his testimony. I mean, who people were targeting, the language they were using to target people.
Well, the big thing that we learned yesterday from Christopher Wiley is that the Department of Justice and the FBI are talking to him and potentially taking a bigger look at Cambridge Analytica and its tactics during and before the 2016 election. But much of what lawmakers heard yesterday was a bit of a reminder as to the extent of this firm's activities. Things about how the firm was using Facebook data to create psychographic profiles of voters so that it could market messages to them, sometimes to sow racial division. Sometimes to keep folks from turning up to the polls. And Christopher Wiley came with a warning that lawmakers had to do something about it. They had to crack down on companies like Facebook that collect and sell access to that data to firms like Cambridge Analytica, and had to take a closer look at what the firm had been doing during the 2016 election.
There were also a number of exchanges about Russia, and I want to play you one with Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat of Delaware, to get your reaction.
Why do you think Cambridge Analytica was testing Putin's aggressive actions? And what threat would it pose to our 2018 elections if this entire data set, all the algorithms that go with it, are currently in the hands of Russian intelligence?
So I don't have a clear answer as to why the company was so engaged in testing Russian expansionism and the leadership of Vladimir Putin. That's a question better put to Steve Bannon. In terms of the dangers for not just American democracy, but other democracies around the world, this data is powerful, and if it's put into the wrong hands, it becomes a weapon.
Tony, your reaction to that?
There are lots of instances where there's some overlap between the work Cambridge Analytica was doing and Russia. One of the things that Wiley was alluding to was the fact that Alexander Kogan, a researcher who developed the app that Facebook that Cambridge Analytica had used on Facebook, had traveled to St. Petersburg. His work was known in Russia. And so one of the fears there is that, either by choice or by force, Russia may have acquired some of the insights from Cambridge Analytica. They may have keylogged or hacked Kogan and others who had access to that data. It's unclear. There was a later exchange about the extent to which Russian trolls who sought to destabilize the U.S. election, whether they had access to some of that information. But Wiley told members of Congress that it was not clear to him that the Internet Research Agency had ever obtained that data. I think more than anything, though, it just shows us that there are so many unanswered questions here about the tactics that Cambridge Analytica employed and the extent to which this Facebook information may have been weaponized two or three steps removed from those who had it in the first place.
Tony Rahm is a technology policy reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us, Tony.
Thanks for having me.
Online platforms' terms and conditions present users with a false choice because using the internet is no longer a choice. Americans cannot opt out of the 21st century.
Whether or not you watch Christopher Wiley's testimony on Wednesday, you might feel the same. See, when you click agree on the dozens of sites you visit and subscribe to, you don't really know what it is you're agreeing to or whether or not you even have the option to decline. It's something that I noticed, especially over the past few weeks, as companies present new terms and service agreements to online users, but the new agreements aren't a result of Facebook's data breach. Natasha Tiku is a senior writer for Wired covering Silicon Valley.
You are part of the millions, probably billions of people that are getting these annoying emails right now. And the reason for it is an upcoming privacy law in Europe called the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR for short. So it's a set of privacy laws that will go into effect on May 25th. And it requires companies to have a legal basis for collecting personal information. And that means your name, address, location data. And one of the bases that companies can collect information on is consent from users, you know, permission. But it can't be the traditional terms of service, pages and pages of dense legal text, and you're just kind of mindlessly clicking yes. It has to be unambiguous, clear, and freely given. And that is why you are getting all these emails, perhaps from companies you didn't even know had your email. And that's kind of why they have to ask.
And this is, just to be clear, this is in the EU, not in the United States, right?
Right. But although it's a European law, it applies to companies that are collecting and processing data about EU residents and citizens. So that means like Facebook and Google, but probably also like even universities in the US, banks, even small businesses. And it's already kind of making an impact beyond Europe's borders, in part because other countries are adopting the same standards. So the EU is kind of trying to establish, like, hit the reset button, you know, on data collection, rampant data collection, and companies know that, you know, GDPR might not be the only thing they have to comply with.
So data collection, not a new issue. I used to cover it. You cover it. Have we in the United States gotten around to figuring out how to control data collection?
I don't think so. And I think that the, you know, the hearings are probably a good example of that. In Europe, privacy is a human right, and they approach it very differently than we do here. And partly because there hadn't been that many restrictions, companies also all share this data between each other to try to micro-target ads to you, customize things. So that means that, you know, if you kind of get one of these trackers like Ghostery, you can see that if you open up NewYorkTimes.com or Wired.com or pretty much any major page, you will see like 14 different trackers that you likely were not aware of.
Now, wasn't the Federal Trade Commission and more broadly the federal government, I believe under the Obama administration, at least tried taking on the issue of data privacy and an internet user bill of rights, particularly for this issue of terms and conditions and privacy? Where does all that stand today?
Well, historically, the FTC has chosen to address those problems, you know, if they run into it with behavioral remedies. So that usually means that companies end up settling for, you know, multi-million dollars and promising to change things in the future and let their books be audited. But as we can see with Cambridge Analytica, Facebook was already under an FTC consent decree, they're called, but basically a settlement. And, you know, it would seem like they are violating it. The FTC is investigating that right now. But I think that's why there's discussion currently about whether our privacy laws and antitrust laws are actually working to curb the dominant companies. For example, instead of requiring that Facebook fix data sharing between WhatsApp after the fact, regulators could say, hey, Facebook can't acquire WhatsApp. You could make kind of structural changes.
Is there any turning back in terms of the data trail that we've all left, whether it was, you know, directly or indirectly?
As far as erasing the trail, honestly, I can't see how that could possibly happen. I mean, one of the things that GDPR incorporates is online identifiers. And I think that's one thing that consumers might not know about. When companies are sharing that data between you, it could be pretty easy to re-identify you, even if they were trying to, you know, hide your identity. And that's the kind of trail that is going to be really hard/impossible to erase.
Lots to pay attention to. Thank you so much for being with us today, Natasha.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha Tiku is a senior writer for Wired covering Silicon Valley. And we want to leave you with this. Right here in New York City, a man was caught on video yelling at a restaurant staff for speaking in Spanish. This after a series of 911 calls on Black Americans for everything from taking a nap to hosting a barbecue. Sometimes we use humor to get through the hard stuff, and this week we saw celebratory cookout protests in Oakland to a crowdfunding campaign to send a mariachi band to the New York man's office. What do you think? Tweet us at The Takeaway. Muchas gracias por escucharnos hoy. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.